He had a busy weekend, variety of topics to cover. Find his work for the Register Guard on the porch, newsstand, online, registerguard.com. You could be a follower on Twitter. Use the handle at AustinMeekRG. Austin Meek, a fine Tuesday to you, sir. How's it going?
Hey, Steve. I have no complaints. How are you doing?
Good. Join the club. Nobody listens anyway. You wrote something late last week. May 6th had marked the 62nd anniversary. Roger Bannister running the first sub-4-minute mile. And here, Runner Central, well back in the late 50s and 60s, they formed a sub-4-mile club. The first member, James Bailey, in 1956. Kind of elaborate on that. Who were those early guys? And they have a little celebration planned?
Yeah, not to be confused with the Mile High Club, which is a different connotation.
Nice!
The sub-4 club, yeah, is, you know, at one time, running a sub-4 mile was really the holy grail of track and field. It's kind of gotten watered down now. I was trying to think of a comparison. It's kind of like passing stats in football. You know, you look at passing stats back in the 60s, and, you know, numbers that would put you in the Hall of Fame back then are barely average now because of how much the game has changed.
Right.
It's kind of that way in track and field, too, where running a sub-4 mile doesn't have the same mystique that it used to have. But back in the day, you know, back in the 60s, that was a huge accomplishment, and the University of Oregon was really the place to be in the United States if you wanted to run a sub-4 mile. There were 11 guys who did it for Bill Bowerman. 10 of them are still living, and 9 of them were back this last weekend for a reunion. I heard it was a cool deal. I didn't make it out there, but I heard it was really cool, and I enjoyed talking to those guys because they really have an interesting perspective of a really different era in track and field.
Yeah, I just to draw a parallel, it would be like getting a group of guys together in the 50s or 60s who threw for like 3,000 yards in football.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, like, so, you know, something that seems totally pedestrian now. Not that running a, you know, a sub-4 mile is easy. I mean, you know, in the Prefontaine, in the Bowerman mile, all 10 guys, I think, broke 4 minutes. Obviously, you have to be in incredibly great shape to be able to run a sub-4 mile, but it's a lot more common now than it used to be.
Now, the Pre, of course, always an elite field, certainly a little more oomph to the event when it's an Olympic year. You wrote about Sonia Richards-Ross, who was obviously quite accomplished. She's the reigning Olympic gold medalist at 400 meters. Excuse me. I'm an observer, not an aficionado, and this will be her last Pre. She's retiring. But if you could explain, man, what she's gone through physically and medically just to get to Hayward on Saturday.
Yeah, well, first of all, you know, this was kind of a weird year for the Pre because it is an Olympic year, and so there was that extra buzz from that. But also it meant that some of the local people that we're used to seeing there weren't competing for various reasons. You know, we didn't have Galen Rupp this year. We didn't have Ashton Eaton. We didn't have Matt Central Wit. So the local angle for the Prefontaine was not what it is in a lot of years. But, you know, Sonia Richards-Ross, even though she's not from Oregon, has kind of become an adopted local because she's been coming to this meet since 2002. And one of the most decorated female sprinters of all time in the United States. So a very recognizable face. And she's coming down to the twilight of her career. This is going to be her last season. She's had 3 surgeries now on her big toe. She's got a foot issue that she just has not been able to shake. She had 1 more surgery so she could come back this year and make another shot at another Olympic team and hopefully try to defend her 400-meter title in Rio. And she's, you know, it's going to be tough. She's got a lot of work to do. I sort of compared it to Kobe Bryant's farewell tour where, you know, in the middle of it, there's some nights when Kobe wasn't looking very good. But then he found it when it counted on the last night. And that's kind of what she's trying to do. You know, her season may not be great, but she's hoping she can put together one great performance at the trial.
Yeah, it sounds like a long shot, but with her talent as she heals up, I guess it's not impossible. But logically, if she were to make the team, that would just further enhance the story. I'm not saying it wouldn't be a miracle, but you'd be like, wow, at 31, that's unbelievable.
Yeah, I mean, she finished seventh in her race at the Prefontaine, and she was hoping to run 50, and she ran 52. So she's definitely not where she wants to be. And there's some women in the 400 who are running really fast, and Allison Felix has been nursing an ankle injury, but she's going to be back. So it's going to be a tough event to make the team. And, you know, she's probably kind of a long shot right now, but, you know, we've seen great athletes at the end of their careers be able to come through on a kind of a one-time deal, and that's what she's trying to do.
When we talked last week, you mentioned you hadn't witnessed so much golf up close in person. It was the NCAA Women's Tournament here, a nice run by the Ducks. And, of course, this week the men in an even better run. Let's start with Aaron, word to the wise, first Duck ever to win the national title. But for those who missed it, a lot of drama. Kind of rewind, take us through what happened on 16 and then the bounce back on 17.
Yeah, now, there was a point yesterday on the back nine where it looked like Aaron Wise was going to lose it. He had a four-stroke lead at the turn and then had a double bogey on number 12, had another double on 16 when he put his tee shot in the water, and that four-stroke lead was gone. He was tied atop the leaderboard. But the thing about Aaron Wise, you know, the thing that I think separates him as a really great golfer is when things go bad, he's just totally unflappable. You know, he's just got this demeanor where nothing gets to him. So when it looked like he was really losing his grip, he was still really confident. In fact, he walked up to the green on 17 with about a 15-foot putt for birdie and said, "I'm going to make this putt," and he did. And to me, that was the moment that he won the tournament. Even though he ended up winning by two strokes, he technically didn't need that putt, but it had to be so demoralizing for the other guys who were chasing him because they knew that they needed him to collapse. Right. They weren't going to catch him without some help. And it looked for a minute like maybe he was going to let him back in, but then with that birdie putt on 17, he just totally slammed the door.
First Duck ever to win it. Unbelievable. And then today they beat LSU, found themselves in the semis. So I'll be perfectly honest. Sometimes I ask to have radio conversation. Now I'm asking because I have no idea what happened today out there.
Well, I got out here this afternoon, and right now they're in the middle of their match with Illinois. When I got off the course, it was totally all square. It was 2-2-1.
What?
So a very competitive match with Illinois this afternoon. You know, they got some really big performances this morning from a couple guys that maybe they didn't expect. Suleiman Raza, who's a Eugene guy, he won his match. And Zach Fouché finished really hot. I think he won his last four holes to win his match. So those two guys really came up big this morning. And right now it's all square, and if Oregon can pull it out this afternoon, then they would be in the finals tomorrow.
Wow. We're talking with our Tuesday leadoff guy, Austin Meek of the Register Guard. Certainly a lot of local attention at the Jane Sanders Stadium. The Duck softballers crushed UCLA game one. Two outs from the series with the freshman on the mound, Megan Kleist, the righty, facing Gabrielle Morris, the lefty, ace Sheridan Hawkins, ready in the bullpen, a lefty. You know, it's very tough to second-guess a great coach who got them there. But I'm curious, in the postgame, was that addressed and maybe at the time what you thought as the situation presented itself?
Yeah, it was addressed after the game. Mike White was asked about it and basically said, you know, he didn't want to bring Hawkins into the game in that situation because, you know, after Kleist gave up the home run, he was worried that, you know, he would use up Hawkins in that first game, and maybe Oregon loses that first game, and then, you know, her confidence is a little bit deflated. You know, what he didn't really say is if he could go back and do it again, would he bring in Hawkins for the start of that inning, which I think was really, you know, in hindsight, maybe the thing that you would do. But, you know, for me, I probably would have done the same thing. I mean, you've got a pitcher who's working on a shutout, who really has it rolling. You know that you've got a third game if you lose. So I think in some ways Mike White probably was coaching maybe a little bit more conservatively, thinking, you know, we've got game three, we've got Hawkins if we need her in game three. Let's just ride with a pitcher who's got the hot hand. But it is hard to lose a game knowing that your best pitcher wasn't on the mound in the most important situation, not only of the game but of the series. I mean, you look back at the key moment of that series, and it was that seventh inning when Oregon had a 2-1 lead and just needed to close it out, two more outs to get to Oklahoma City.
No, I sensed as it was happening that, as the ball was leaving the yard, I just, you know, saw a graphic in my head, second guess. For those who missed it, Morris went yard, UCLA won an extra innings, and they're headed to Oklahoma City. But this Baylor football mess, I mean, you worked in Big 12 country, and of course there's these awful allegations of sweeping multiple sexual assaults under the rug in the name of winning football games. You know, considering the amount of cases here, the supposed effort to intimidate victims, what should our level of disgust be? Or should we actually be shocked anymore until things drastically change?
Well, I was, to be totally honest with you, I was surprised that Baylor fired Art Briles. I didn't think it was going to happen, and maybe that speaks to how jaded I've become about college sports, when obviously the guy deserved to be fired. I mean, you can't read the allegations and the reports and not come to the conclusion that this guy deserved to be fired. But you know, it's just, you got to remember how bad Baylor was before Art Briles. And he came in and just, you know, built a program that was the absolute dregs of the Big 12 into a team that now has won the Big 12, and look, that shouldn't matter at all when you're talking about something on the scale of sexual assault, but sadly, it does seem to matter in a lot of places. And, you know, I guess I'd like to applaud Baylor for doing the right thing, sort of, but, you know, to me, it's an example of, again, how athletic departments are so concerned about image that they can't admit there's a problem until it becomes a full-blown crisis where you have to fire everybody. You know, it's either everything's great, nothing to see here, or, okay, we got to blow the whole thing up because it's obviously totally corrupt. You know, if Baylor had dealt with this sooner when the first allegations came up, I think Art Briles still has his job. I think they could have fixed this situation to the extent that you can fix it. You know, granted, damage had already been done, but if they had addressed this sooner, I think they could have avoided what happened here, which was obviously a horrible, heartbreaking situation for the people involved, the victims, and a bad situation for Baylor as a university, too.
All right. Final thought. Let's end on something a little more upbeat. The NBA Finals are set. Warriors trying to follow up the Magic regular season and repeat. Does LeBron, with a healthy cast, win a title for Cleveland? Haven't seen that since I was only four. A lot of good storylines. The one seeds. Do you have a preference? You know, what's your read on what appears to be pretty sweet, highly anticipated finals?
Well, I'm really interested in the psychology of this matchup because, you know, it's a little bit weird to think about the team from Cleveland, you know, somehow being anything other than the underdog, but yet you got the LeBron versus Steph Curry thing where, you know, people, for whatever reason, people seem to view Steph as like the scrappy underdog and LeBron as the guy who's blessed with these great physical gifts that he's never quite gotten everything out of, which, to me, that whole narrative is a little bit overblown. But it's just, it makes you think, is Golden State, the favorite here, and LeBron is somehow the underdog? I don't know. I think it's going to be a really entertaining series. And I'm really looking forward to watching it. I kind of think Golden State's going to win. But I do have some doubts about that after seeing the way Oklahoma City pushed the Warriors. I didn't think there was a team that was going to push the Warriors that way in these playoffs. And Golden State looks a little bit more vulnerable than they did, certainly coming off that regular season. So I think it's going to be a really good series.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it as well. And again, I have no idea who I'm pulling for. I guess once it tips off, maybe I'll figure it out. All right, you could catch his work in the Register Guard here on Tuesdays on Twitter. The handle is at AustinMeekRG. Always look forward to it. Thanks for joining us, Austin.
Okay, thanks, Steve.
All right, take it easy.